This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. So the only thing left to say is, you in. Order now on the McDonald's app. You can also get reward points delivered too. So the ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus. Rewards registration required. Points only on menu items. Delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Back of the chest. Coronavirus Self-Isolation Podcast.
Hello and welcome to Back of the Chest, the lockdown sessions. I'm your host, Chris Hambling, and I'm here to guide you through the latest in our attempts to stay connected to the real world. We'll meet the panel after this short message.
No paywall, no subscription. Back of the Nest. Fan-created podcasts, videos and articles. Free forever.
Right, meet the panel time. First up, Mr. Mike Scott. Love it. That's all that's needed. We'll find out what quality beverage that was later on. We've got Patrick O'Connor.
Hello, how are you? I can't stop laughing. So I apologize. I'm amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it will become apparent when people hear the quiz later on to why we're feeling quite like we are. I mean, my voice sounds tired.
I'm giddy.
But it was emotional. As a result of some quiz-based work, we've also got producer Sam lurking. Hello, Sam.
Hello. All right?
Yeah, I'm fine. Yourself?
Yeah.
Yeah, how's things been going?
Yeah, it's all right.
What have you been up to in the lockdown? Keeping busy?
Yeah. Watching some films, you know.
Some films. Enjoying any refreshments of any kind?
I mean, we may have had a delivery of Harvey's that has been opened.
Yeah. The thing is, they go bad, don't they, really quickly,
beer? Yeah, you got to drink the beer quickly.
Yeah. I mean, plus you can't just have one, can you? Because I think it's dangerous.
No. And, not driving anywhere, so.
No, because you're responsible, and that's the reasons. Why? Patrick, how have things been going with you in lockdown over there in the United States of America, led by a complete psychopath?
Yeah, it's been interesting. I'm a bit of a hoarder, so I've decided to clean up what I've been hoarding for the last, I've been in this house now for 19 years. So I'm doing a little bit of that. My wife wants me to paint the entire house. So we're going to order paint. I've got plenty of time. I've got nothing else to do besides teach from Monday to Friday and do nothing on the weekend. So that's about it, really.
Inside of the house or outside or both?
Oh, no. We got new siding and new roof last year, so the outside looks great. The inside just has to be, touched up a little bit. So just, a few rooms, kitchen, living room, bedroom, possibly.
I mean, it sounds like she's absolutely right if you've done the outside up and you haven't bothered to do the inside.
Cheers.
It's fake. What's the matter with you? Mike, you've not said anything specifically yet other than the noise of a can. How's your lockdown been going?
Well, having just found out that I'm allowed to sunbathe as an absolute sun worshipper, once my kids have gone back to their mother, that is what I shall be doing. And the possible news, the possible carrot in front of my nose that kids might be back at school on June the 1st if they're in reception. Oh, God, when I heard that, I pointed out earlier, I was down on the floor like platoon style with my hands in the air, just praising the Lord. I'm having this drink to Boris because I hate him, but at least he said a couple of things that are making me happy.
Listen, as a teacher, I am in America, but still a teacher. there is no chance schools open anytime soon. There's no chance unless you want to have a total apocalypse of a pandemic to have.
Give me my moment, Patrick. Give me my moment.
Okay, never mind.
You got to remember, Patrick, and I suppose, you know, Trump's very similar in the sense that all he thinks about is the economy above everything else. You know, and in this current environment, that's the driver to get people back to work. They've got to get the kids back to school. So you can see why that's being said there. That's the motivation.
Yeah, I get that. But like I mentioned when I was on last time, we're lucky. We have an awful president. We have actually very good governors. And our governor, Cuomo, thinks first of people's health. So a bunch of the economy is absolutely getting destroyed in New York State. He has a very good plan to open up, and schools are the last thing on his plan to open up, because he understands that if you open up schools again, you're in for a huge... I understand that you have to have kids be in school for people to go to work, but it doesn't work because, like I said, there's no way for kids to social distance. And the way that schools teach now, you've got 30 kids in a room, and it's just, there's just no way you can do it without causing a major health problem. But I understand what you're saying, but it just doesn't make any feasible mental or health sense to open schools when... Yeah. They can't social distance, but anyway.
No, fair point. And look, to give it context, we're recording this just after the announcement from Boris Johnson. It's actually an hour and 40 minutes after the announcement of Boris Johnson because of factors. so for my part, I really, other than watching the PM's announcement today, I've been doing my level best to avoid any mention of what's going on in terms of people adhering to lockdown rules and things like that, because I was getting way too angry about it, and you just can't control what other people do. And seeing social media pop up with parks full of people and all that kind of stuff, you know, as much as I'm a little frustrated that the announcement gives people, shall we say, scope to interpret rules the way they want to, part of me is kind of slightly relieved that maybe a little bit of the attention will come off that. But obviously the fear is that all of that will end up with us in a, you know, periods of on and off lockdown for the foreseeable future. But that's a danger anyway, I guess, until a vaccine's found. Anyway, it's quite enough serious stuff with that. I am eyeing up a beer subscription. I've already forgotten the name of it, but I used to be a member of a wine club, Laithwaite's. But ever since I was diagnosed with diabetes, and also ever since I developed the problem that I can't stop drinking wine when I start, I had to cancel that subscription because, you know, a crate of wine every month is possibly too much. But a crate of beer every month, I've reasoned, is perfectly reasonable in the current scenario. So I'm looking forward to trying all the stupidly named weird beers like they do on the preview pod. So we'll see how that goes. Anyway, do download the Pitch Sport Football app, Google Pitch Sport Football, to find it. They are still supporting us throughout all of this, so please support them. And we'll get obviously more content, hopefully, as the football comes back, which I guess we'll talk about a little bit later on. You can also get hold of us by leaving us a WhatsApp voice message, 0203-575-1266. And on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube, just search Back of the Nest to find us on there. Email is hi@backofthenest.com. We've signed up for a TikTok account, but are too old to currently work out how to use it. But we might be doing some content on that, especially if we can make the young person, DR, deal with that. And yeah, get your reviews in iTunes or your chosen podcast app. 5 stars, please. Other than that, we don't mind what on earth you write. So that's all that out of the way. Let's get into some football chat. So as you know, we've been working on the team of the decade with your voting over the last few weeks. It is now complete. The final place was taken in midfield by Mile Jedinak, winning that place over James McArthur. I can run you down the full team now. So in goal, we have Julian Speroni. Right back is Joel Ward. Left back is Patrick Van Aanholt. Centre-back pairing of Delaney and Dan. Mile Jedinak and Johan Kabay in central midfield. Zaha Bolasie on the wings. In behind the striker, Darren Ambrose. And that striker is Glenn Murray. The players that missed out are quite impressive. If you just check out our social feeds to see the details of that as well. But some interesting reactions, which I'll let Mike run through in just a second. But let's get the panel's reaction first. And I'm going to start with you, Patrick, I think. What did you think of that team overall, considering how it was voted for and the discussions we've had?
I think based on the discussions and what ended up, I think it ended up being a quite good team. Jules and goal, I love the back four. I'm mentioned it before, I'm not a huge PVA fan, but when you think of the last 10 years, we haven't had anybody that could really challenge him. So no problem with the back four, Delaney, Dan, no issues there really. Kabay, Jednak, nice balance there. Yannick and Wilf, I mean, come on. Can't go any... Ambrose, Murray. As Dan always said, having him, imagine him playing in a side with Wilf and Yannick just next to him and Murray up front. That would have scored a lot of goals. So overall, I think in the last 10 years, it's quite a balanced and a decent side. I like it. I like it a lot.
Drunk Sam, have you got any opinions on that team?
It's pretty decent.
It is pretty decent, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a little bit of a championship flavour, isn't there, based on the last 10 years. But how do you think it would do in the Premier League? I should never have interrupted your train of thought, should I? I apologise for that.
I don't have a lot of thoughts. I still feel like Murray is not Premier League calibre, to be fair. I mean, I've been proven wrong, but, you know. Or maybe Jedi. But it's a team that speaks to the heart, really, isn't it?
It is. What a lovely way to put it. And I sort of agree with your comments on Murray and Jednak. But that will almost certainly alienate me as well as you from most of the listeners. Mike, your thoughts?
I think the front six is great. I would say that our current defence is... defenders that are on the books are probably better than the back four there, but you know, we're talking about team of the decade, services to the club, that kind of stuff, and yeah, can't argue with any of that. Do you want me to give you some thoughts from the listeners?
Oh, I really do. I'm going to check out Facebook while you're looking at the Twitter ones.
Okay. Well, Luke Herbert said, hard to argue in terms of impact. I think that's pretty much what we've been saying. More talented players in certain spots, certainly. More impactful over the decade, that's the big question. So he's definitely put more succinctly the same thing that we've said. Kieran Moore, Luka over Jedinak. There's always going to be somebody that isn't happy, isn't there? Adam, spot on. Ian, filth. Excellent. It's good. It's good that's still a comment that people use. I thought it was stopped in about 2005. Good work, Ian. Paul Rahilly, nothing wrong with that team. Glad Darren Ambrose is in it. Yes, absolutely. Always one of my favourites. I think everyone's the same. He absolutely caned it in the polls. Alex Duncan, a team full of heart will win when it matters. That's what the best games Palace have been involved in prove. Yep, fair play. And Eggy the Eagle, see what you've done there. All great players for Palace in their different times, but together it looks a bit championship. I was watching the 2013 playoff final today, and I was actually thinking that despite the fact, obviously, that was a championship side, I don't think it's any weaker than, say, Norwich or even the Sheffield United side that are flying pretty high in the Premier League this season, or were anyway. I'm not sure we've made enormous strides, even with money that has been spent. It's hard. I think it's harder to sort of differentiate between Championship and Premier League players than it ever has been, really.
It's definitely an argument to say that those players playing at their best in that team, you know, those that were predominantly Championship. And I suppose, you know, in terms of Murray's best days for us were in the Championship, as was Darren Ambrose. And I suppose you can look at the influence of Jednak and Delaney in the Championship as well, and point to that being the strongest perhaps back then, maybe. But yeah, at their peak in that team, I think, you know, I think it would be a very competitive team at the top level. A few other comments in. Chewy wrote a fairly long one in there, but the general consensus he's saying there was, you know, if you think about, you know, looking at ability, you would probably say Wan-Bissaka is a better footballer than Joel Ward. You would say Sacco is a better centre-back than probably either Delaney or Dan. And then you would just sort of, when you start to think about the reasons why Delaney is so well thought of, you know, it does show that it's probably, you know, impact over ability. But I think that's kind of the point. Aaron Mitchell got in touch saying in their prime, that's a top eight Prem team. I don't know about top eight, but I like the ambition from Aaron there. Graham O'Brien, definitely heart ruling head. Delaney was a cult hero, but quality wise, he said something unkind about about Delaney that I won't repeat. And he was talking about how, you know, Kalyan and Aaron Wan-Bissaka were better right backs than Ward as well. Steve Sheffield, solid spine to the team with three quality flair players behind Muzza. James Howard surprised that no Wan-Bissaka, so it does suggest it's a sentimental 11. Jamie Morton's gone with Clone and Bissaka. I think he meant Kalyan. I don't think we're, you know, at the stage where we're cloning players. And Adrian in Canada, he's got in Canada as a surname, but I don't think that's a surname. He says, I wonder what this looks like if it was done on most minutes played in each position. That wouldn't be far off, I don't think, which is a good point, you know, in terms of, you know, minutes played for Palace over the course of 10 years, it would probably look very similar. Over to you, Patrick.
Yeah, you know what? The more I look at it, it has a bit of a cult hero type of a lineup to it. Could you think about just, I mean, I'm sure you guys today or at some point must have watched the playoff final again. You think about Speroni, Delaney, Ward, Wilf, how they played in that final, how great that final was, and Jednak, obviously. I mean, it's got a little bit of that cult hero stuff. We're not really talking about necessarily Premier League great players. We're talking about players that over those 10 years, you think back at a great memory, saying, oh, I remember Glenn Murray scoring those goals, getting us promoted, and how great Yannick was in the semi-final against Brighton and Kabai. How, you know, it's got a little bit of that whole, oh, these are cult hero type things, you know, PVA scoring goals to relegate teams and that kind of stuff. So I love the team, but again, I have to agree, there has a little bit of a cult hero recency type bias type thing to it.
Absolutely right. Anyway, obviously that's now completed. Really enjoyed doing that with the listeners, and I hope you enjoyed it too. So next up, we're going to look at matches of the decade. So we're going to do a little bit of research on that and start putting some options up for people to look at. Obviously, quite a hard choice when you start looking at the different seasons and trying to pick the key matches, either the most enjoyable or the most meaningful through each kind of season, if you like. But we'll be putting those up soon. So check out all of our socials and get involved in that as well. And I think that's going to be a really fascinating turn of events by the end of it. So, yeah, more to come on that soon. So next up, I mean, we've been doing a lot of these presenter all-time favourite 11s. And
ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximise your home ground advantage with McDelivery. You in? Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Well, another one for you right now.
No paywall, no subscription. Back of the Net. Fan-created podcasts, videos and articles. Free forever.
Right, it is time for an all-time Palace 11, and we have a very special guest from the preview show. It's Sam Hesketh. You're right to cheer the preview show.
Am I a special guest or am I a special in inverted commas guest?
I mean, you can make your own decision on that if you like.
No inverted commas then.
Good. Yeah. And that is exactly how I meant it. And you've been doing some fine work on the preview show during lockdown. What's been your highlights so far?
Well, I can tell you that my highlights were not Albert and Terry talking about baby vomit or Terence asking about whether we have belly button fluff. Those weren't the highlights. I think the highlight is probably us. I think it was just me and Albert talking about which Palace manager we'd want to self-isolate with.
Yeah, I very much enjoyed that. And, you know, it's weird. I often enjoy the podcasts that I'm not on more because sometimes losing the host gives it a slightly more informal feel. So that's not a reflection on young Terence at all, but it was a cracking episode. Anyway, we've
caught you up on the belly button fluff.
Yeah.
So I was always under the impression that if you're a hairy guy, then it happens more because the hair lets it travel down towards your belly button. by catching your jumper. So as a man that's freakishly unhairy, I've never had any belly button fluff. But then very hairy mates of mine tend to have loads. So is there truth in that?
I'm glad we're back on this topic. I am not a particularly hairy bloke, and I have some. So I reckon you're probably right.
Well, I'm a very hairy bloke. And I would say moderate. But I mean, if I go into too much detail, it's going to get unpleasant, I think, probably. Well, I mean, you know, we've already talked before we started recording about what's not in your all-time Palace 11, so I am already slightly disappointed, but that's a good place to start, isn't it?
It is. So, unfortunately, I'll preface this to follow on to Hambo's point there. No Kalinko, no Hennessy and goal.
Boo! Boo!
So, sorry about that. My favourite goalkeeper is one that's actually talented, so neither of those got in there, sorry. Yeah, I mean, I've been going since 1990, so really since then, the only two goalies I can consider are Nigel Martin and Jules. Pretty tough one, to be honest, because they're both great. I edged towards Jules. Obviously, he was there a bit longer. Probably wasn't as good a goalkeeper as Martin, but I can't believe anyone who supports Palace feels anything other than unconditional love for Jules. So he is certainly the goalkeeper that makes my all-time favourite 11.
I have to say, when you said edge towards Jules, I started laughing back to one of our WhatsApp conversations, but let's not dwell on that. I did, and we'll talk later in the show about our watching of the playoff semi-final second leg, but I fell in love with Jules all over again after rewatching that sensational the performance in that game.
Absolutely. And not only that save, which was unbelievable, but the interview with him after the game where he's sort of choking up a little bit, but still finds the time to talk about how great Wilf is. You know, it sort of says everything about him. He's a great goalie and an even greater bloke.
Okay. So what's next?
Right. So I'm just going to do a 4-4-2 because I can't be done with all this fancy Dan 2020 nonsense. So my right back is Mark Edworthy.
What the hell?
So I think that Mark Edworthy is a very good player. He never really gets talked about, but I think when you mention him, people who remember him sort of go, oh yeah, he was pretty good actually. It's sort of in the same way as Emerson Boyce. You sort of forget Emerson Boyce a bit, but he was good. And I just really remember really, really liking Edworthy at the time. He was pretty good going forward. He was a very good defender. Randomly played at sweeper at some point. But yeah, he was a big favourite of mine at the time. So as this is a favourite 11, I believe, rather than a sort of best, mm-hmm. best performing 11, he definitely goes in there because I was a massive fan of his.
When I had hair, I had the same hair as Mark Edworthy. You know, the curtains that were a bit too thick?
Just a very of its time haircut.
Indeed, indeed. All right. Okay, on we go.
So on the other side, my left back is going to be Dean Gordon. He was such a good player going forward. All the cliches about his sort of rocket left foot and all that is quite an obvious one. I just remember really liking him bombing down the wing and punting the ball really hard. Again, when I was younger, he was a big favourite of mine, so maybe sort of nostalgia takes over. But I remember him scoring a couple of really good goals and they stick in my mind. So he is going to give us some pace down the wing.
I mean, he was in mine as well, I'm pretty sure, and he was quality. I was always surprised he didn't really get any international recognition. I think he might have got an under-21 appearance or maybe a B call-up at one stage.
The elusive England B cap.
Exactly. And, went on to be brilliant for Middlesbrough as well. So, great choice.
So moving on to the middle, my two centre-halves. The first is Tony Popovic, who I believe Mike had in his as well. Just a really good defender. You know, he could play a bit as well. I remember when we signed him from Sanfrecce, I think it was, in Japan. Obviously, no one knew anything about him. And he settled in pretty well to start with, I think, and then just got better and better. Scored one of the best own goals I've ever seen away at Portsmouth, which is always worth mentioning, and could take a hell of a penalty. So he's one half of my centre-backs, and the other is Mamadou Sakho. First of all, brilliant defender. I think a lot of people sort of forget just how good a player he is when he's doing his Cruyff turns in the six-yard box. And while he does have sort of a moment of madness every now and again, I can't remember us having a defender who was so comfortable passing the ball, getting the play moving, whilst also being a very, very good defender. And I think for all the times you say that, you know, talking about forward players, you want to be excited, you want to see players have skill. Maybe not the first thing you want for a centre-half, but when he does his skills and they do come off, it's just brilliant. I just really enjoy watching him play. So for the odd heart-in-mouth moment compared to his actual ability, I think he's really enjoyable to watch, and I love him.
All right, good choice. Certainly agree with Sakho, and obviously Mike will undoubtedly agree with the choice of Popovic.
Right, moving into midfield, the centre. The first is a current squad member. It's James McArthur. He's been with us a while now, hasn't he? So obviously we've had time to get to know what kind of a player he is. And as much as everyone likes skillful players, which I certainly do, and you'll see further on in the team, I think all fans, certainly myself included, love players who give everything. And we've had quite a few of those players over the years, some with more limited ability than others. But I think James McArthur is legitimately a really, really good player. You know, his energy is boundless. He can pass. He's got good skill. Just an all-round very good player. And I think when we look back on him after he leaves, whenever that is, everyone will have fond memories of him. I think we'll miss him when he's not there. And that leads me nicely onto my central midfielder partner, who's Johan Cabaye. Definitely a player who was taken for granted by a lot of people when he was in the team. He is someone that we really, I mean, I think we really miss. I think we'd be a better team with him in the team now. He's just got everything, you know. He can, his vision is brilliant, his passing is brilliant, he could tackle, he could score. And he was a bit of a shit, you know. He liked nipping at players after the ball. He was mouthy. He rolled around a bit, which I hate when it's against us. But when it's Johan, I'm like, yeah, well, someone obviously must have breathed on him, and that's unacceptable. So I think, you know, we've had some brilliant central midfielders since I've been going. Jeff Thomas, for example. It's a little honourable mention to Andy Roberts, who I was really, really into when we bought him.
Okay.
So we had some good central midfielders, but I think Jimmy and Yo are my two favourites.
I think interesting to hear you mention about the sort of dark side of Cabaye's game, because we've talked about him a bit and about him being underappreciated, but you're absolutely right. And I think, was it Dele Alli that he had a couple of real...
Yeah.
Sort of nasty little moments with, because he obviously wound him up to a point where, you know, Ali's always been a petulant sort of little child of a player anyway, but he really got to him. And a couple of niggly little moments there. So I like that. And as for Macca, not one that I would have picked, but I think you're absolutely right in that people will look back and think about how great a player he was for us. And, you know, he comes under that category of underrated players. And I know I underrate him. You know, whenever I start thinking about who I would replace in the team, for some reason, it's always pick him. And I know I underrate James McArthur. So, good choices.
So moving out to the wings, these are a bit more obvious and sort of give us that flair as opposed to the sort of central industry. They can go on either side. They're both good enough. The first is Victor Moses. As I say, an obvious choice. When he was in the team, he was just clearly a cut above. You know, our team was average when he was there. We had some times where we were all right. But there were just some games when you watched Vic, in the championship against, like, you know, teams near the bottom, and he would just embarrass them. He was such a fluid player when he had the ball. You know, he was either getting past you or you're going to kick him, which is, you know, what you want from your wingers, really. And he was absolute joy to watch. I was devastated when he left. I really, really didn't want him to go, but obviously the situation as it was meant that he had to. And seeing how well he's done in his career is great. I can't begrudge him it. I love him. And, you know, I think having him in the team would be great. And on the other side, even less of a surprise, is my favourite player of all time, Wilfried Zaha. Don't really need to talk about him much. We all know how good he is, even this year when he's arguably not having his best season. He still does things that make, you know, the hairs on your arm stand up, makes you stand up, makes opposition fans hate him, makes Brighton substitutes look very silly when they try and rile him up. He's just my favourite player ever. He's the best. I love him. And I've said this a million times on the preview show, I don't want £100 million. I want Wilf. So he was first name on the team sheet as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, actually, I was going to go back to the back four. That back four is very underrated. I mean, it takes Ed Worthy, I remember primarily from this 97 team that got promoted. Dean Gordon, again, you talk about, we've complained about not having pure left-footed left backs. And, you know, I put Sansa on my team, but Dean Gordon was brilliant. I totally loved that Sam picked him because I totally had forgotten how good Dean Gordon was. It wasn't a long, long time, but he was a good, good player. And I, again, he picked Sacco, which, again, people underrate Sacco as a defender. I absolutely love Mama Sacco, and I'm really glad Sam picked him. So I'm loving the side so far.
All right, well, I'll jump in on Victor Moses then, because it didn't even enter my brain. And I think you kind of touched on the reason why, Sam, and it's the fact that he left and had to leave when he did. But I remember thinking when he sort of broke through, you know, it took him a little while to, you could see straight away that he was, you know, going to be, you know, an international class player. And he'd been talked about since he was a, you know, 15-year-old, possibly even younger, when he was some, I remember reading an article about him scoring 5 in a cup final, and sort of barely breaking a sweat and things like that. But when he really started to shine, I remember feeling so sorry for him that there wasn't enough quality around him, because, you know, he had to make, you know, all the chances himself. It's a little bit like when Wilf broke through, to be honest. But, you know, there wasn't really enough around him until that little purple patch, wasn't it, when we had Sinclair, Moses and Morrison, I think it was, under Warnock.
Mm-hmm.
And as a three, they just clicked. And you know, as much as Warnock didn't want to play Clinton, he had to, because of just how well that three worked. And I think that was a time where you saw what Moses could have offered with enough quality around him. And it's definitely a one that got away, but, you know, what a career he's had.
Yeah, absolutely. He like we say, he was one that had to leave for the good of the club, but you wouldn't begrudge him. I don't want to say well done to a Chelsea player. I hate Chelsea. But when he was playing under Conte, he looked absolutely brilliant, you know, and it didn't surprise any Palace fans as just to how good a player he was in whatever position he was in. Plus, at Cristan Ball, he could have scored and he sort of air-kicked a little bit. And that's because he loves Palace, I reckon.
Yeah, yep.
So moving on to the final two. That was tough. We've had loads of good strikers over the past 30 odd years that I've been going. And you know, there are honourable mentions that was really tough to leave out that I loved. Matt Janssen, for example. Andy Johnson, it's hard not to love AJ. But
I specifically said no honourable mentions so that you could somehow get two things out.
I wasn't allowed a sub bench, so I've semantics. But my front two, first one is Glenn Murray. It's hard to explain. Oh, it's not hard to explain because he scored loads of goals, but compared to some of the players you've had, like AJ and Wright and Bright and Chris Armstrong, I just loved Glenn Murray. That year, the year before, he was brilliant for us. When Jermaine Easter was getting in the team over him, I was like livid every week when I saw the team sheet because I didn't like Jermaine Easter. I thought he was crap. And there was just something about Murray, even though I think he only scored 7 goals. I was like, he just, there's something about him. I think he's going to be really good. Obviously, we got him on a free from Brighton and then he scored against them. That's fun. But the year that we went up and he'd scored 20 odd goals by Christmas, he was just absolutely unplayable. And there's nothing about him that you would say, this is why he's a brilliant, you know, he's not the fastest striker. He doesn't score all of his goals with his head, but he just did everything really, really well. He's a pain in the arse. He could score from range. He could score from the 6-yard box. He could score headers. He's quite an unassuming bloke, but he was such a good striker. And I just, you know, loved watching him play. I was, again, the way that he was treated when he left was really bad. And I felt pissed off that we'd done that to him. And he's been all right. I don't think anyone was good for Brighton really this year because they're awful, but I think he's been all right for them the year before. So he's still got it in his locker, even though he's getting on. And then his partner, who, were it not for Wilf, would be my favourite player of all time, is Clinton Morrison. You know, he's a Roo boy from South London, come through the Youth Academy, scored on his debut. I remember that well. And he's played in some teams that were crap as well. And he just looked good. He's full of confidence. He backs it up. You know, we all know how many times he got caught offside and did the sort of like slouch and sort of kissing his teeth and all that. And that's part of what I love about him, because he had a bit of an attitude even at that young age, but he could score goals. And I think when you watch the games that Palace have been putting on their YouTube this week against Stockport, on the Twitter, when the Portsmouth game, the game before, you see just how good a player and just how good his all-round game was. You know, he was a striker that came alive in the box, like the cliche says, but he did a lot for the team. And, you know, when he came back the second time, even though the team under Dowie, the year we were trying to get back up, wasn't great, seeing him and AJ together was a lot of fun. And, yeah, like Hambo said, Warnock didn't want to play him, but he couldn't not in the end, because he epitomises, for me, everything that I love about Palace. He's local, he come through the youth team, he went away and came back, much like Wilf. I couldn't not have him in the team. He's the best.
I love those selections. I didn't pick either, but I'm right with you on your reasoning. I'm trying desperately to remember what Dougie said when we interviewed him a few years back about why in that season he was picking Easter over Murray. Just trying to think, the only person I think might remember might be Patrick, but possibly not. But I think there was some kind of off-field reason why, you know, he was trying to motivate Murray and basically explain to him that, you know, you're going to have to work to get in this team. You're not doing what I'm asking you to do. And he wasn't getting it. And there was some process that Dougie was going through just to try and reach him, try and get him. I think it was getting him to train harder, maybe, because he wasn't a willing trainer at the time. Something along those lines. But totally get what you mean. It was a bizarre time when Easter was getting in over ahead of Murray. But the everything you say about Clinton, and I think in particular the bit about, you know, not really understanding how good a player he was. Because when you actually stop and look at the logic of it, I mean, he scored more goals than Mark Bright, and he doesn't get talked about the same way that Mark Bright does and should. And I don't think it was his 100th goal, but it was around that time when he scored probably the favourite goal I've ever seen him score, which was against QPR, where the ball was played up to him with his back to goal. He sort of did this weird sort of pirouette and just backheel volley over the keeper. And it was just, I sort of remember seeing him do it. And I thought, did he just, was that a mistake? Did he accidentally score? And it was just, but it was deliberate, but it was just so brilliant and it didn't really get any attention. Anyway, over to you, Patrick.
Yeah, I think the problem with Clinton is, if you think about his career at Palace, he never did anything when he was on the team. You think about, you remember Clinton for him. I remember him very much for Stockport. He was part of that team that just avoided relegation. I remember that team that got to the League Cup semi-final and got clattered by Liverpool in the second leg. When you think about Clinton's team, unfortunately, they didn't really do great things. Unless you guys can, you know, remind me, is there promotion in Clinton's for Palace? Was there one that I can remember? I can't remember it. So that's unfortunate. But you're right. The goals that he scored were tremendous as far as the amount. But again, Bright, he's got the ZDS Cup. He's got the FA Cup final. He's got third place, you know, in 1991. So that's why I think why you remember Brighty more than Clinton. But as far as production, Clinton was, I loved him too. Like, I'm with Sam on that. Local kid, that rude boy thing, I love about that South London attitude that he had. And him being called the pest by Jordan, I love that about him. He was a pest and irritating. But yeah, I mean, but again, I think the only thing with Clinton, like I said, just didn't have that really great moment you could think about as far as being successful with Palace.
Essentially, you lot have just explained a lot better the same reason I put Clinton in the team. But even now, you know, he's pure Palace. Like, his tweets, you know, they're always Palace related. If they want a pundit on the radio to talk Palace, he's the man. And he says it with conviction and you believe him. And he really was just, when I was a kid, the player that I was most up for watching. It just got me most excited about football at Palace. So, yeah, excellent. I, as for the back four, Edworthy and Gordon, I don't remember. It's pre my Palace days. But looking at their stats, I'm sure they were, particularly Dean Gordon, pretty great to watch. I think we got four of the same players in our favourite 11 there. So I had Popovic, Sacco, Wilf and Morrison. Probably yours is a little bit more of a balanced side than mine, though, I will say that.
The one thing I will say, just to finish up for Clinton, because Mike was saying about he's on in the media and used as a pundit a lot. He's legitimately a really, really good pundit. He knows his stuff. I used to, you know, you see him on the sort of Football League highlights, I guess when he was maybe still with Exeter. He knows his stuff top to bottom, and seeing someone with the charisma and sort of character and personality of him on telly a lot is brilliant, you know, and it also helps when they sort of bring him in during Palace stuff. He genuinely still loves the club. I don't think there's any sort of any doubt about that. And long may it continue, really, because the more Clinton Morrison I have on my telly, the better.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I do think there was, he obviously left, and I don't think the way he came across, you know, was going on to bigger and better things to a point in some of the things that he said. And I think there was a period of time where he perhaps didn't really refer to Palace. But when he came back, I think it was probably about halfway through that season where he started talking, you know, look, you know, this is my club. It doesn't matter who I, you know, I think he was a Spurs fan as a kid. It's like, it doesn't really matter that, you know, this is where I came through. This is where I'm happy. Or, you know, this is the club that I love. And it really sort of grew from there for me. But no, great choices. Fantastic favourite 11. Thank you very much, Eskif. You've got to go and get your dinner now, so we'll let you run. Thanks.
I have. All right. Cheers, guys.
Fintans.
Right, interesting stuff. Some news, of course, that's come out of the club, which was, it's always nice to get actual news to talk about. And that's that Scott Dann has signed an extension to his contract until the summer of 2021. A player who, by all accounts, very nearly left in the last transfer window, and was obviously contract coming to an end at the end of the season, obviously. But it's, you know, featured in the team more, you know, on a slightly more regular basis, now fully back from injury, obviously advancing in years. But what do you make of that? I'll start with you, actually, Mike. What were your thoughts when you heard that? Did it sort of come out of the blue a little bit?
No, I don't think it did. Don Firefield pointed out it's probably not something new. It's probably just something that's been leaked to give a bit of news. I thought he was pretty much done for, and I wasn't too worried about him going. I thought he probably deserved it in that he looks as though he wants a couple more seasons, and I thought if he dropped down a league or two, he'd probably make sure he was an absolutely integral part of a Championship or a League One side, you know, maybe becoming a bit of a cult hero. But he stuck his ground, and because of injuries, he ended up back in the side and doing well and showing that we can be a little bit quick to dismiss people sometimes. So right now, I'd say he's a fairly integral part of a very injury-prone central defence.
Definitely. And I suppose you've got the argument for cover and the argument as a reward for not only sort of the part he's played in the season currently on hold, but, you know, obviously the years he's given us as a quality player, you know, as reflected in the fact he was voted in the team of the decade by the listeners. But I suppose, Patrick, there's another argument in that if he held a value in that January transfer window where someone was willing to take him on and possibly give us money for him, that by getting him back under contract, that puts us in a similar position in the next window or two as well, whenever that might be.
Yeah, I find it hard to wrap my head around any kind of football news with what's going on in the world and no football. But again, as Mike said, it probably was done before and it's kind of put out there now to give us some news. But I've got no issue with it. My only thought when I thought about it was, well, what does that mean for Mama Sako? Because if we're going to keep Dan, at some point, some centre-half is going to have to leave because we're not going to keep as many as we have. So that's my only thought, was that Sacco's definitely off now. But again, off when? Because the season, who knows when it's going to start up again. So who knows?
Yeah, for sure. I'm not going to make Sam think again by asking her opinion. But I think we've probably just covered that. But we are going to talk now. We mentioned it earlier about rewatching. So the playoff final was actually played on the day of recording. But I didn't watch that back. There's a couple of reasons for that. And the main one is it's a lot of football to be played to watch one penalty. Whilst I remember it vividly, it's one of my favourite days being a Palace fan. The idea of sitting there watching 120 minutes after sitting there watching the full playoff final yesterday, I just didn't have it in me today because I miss football a lot. And it just would have, I don't know, I'd have had a mixed feelings, but it was a glorious moment. And I've absolutely watched the penalty that Wilf got and Phillips smashing it in, and that's my joy from that. But the playoffs semi-final second leg I watched in full on my TV. It was so pleasing that they managed to get the Sky content in full HD and all that kind of stuff, because it was like being back there for a moment. I just took my mind back to watching it and just thoroughly enjoyed it. And there's just so many funny moments, you know, the stuff beforehand where they're talking up Will Buckley, who, having watched it back, he was just a kick and run merchant. He had nothing about him. And it's no wonder he didn't kick on as Poyet predicted that he would be better than Zaha. He was a player playing at his absolute peak because he had massive confidence. But all he had one move. It was just knock the ball ahead of him and sprint. That made me laugh. And then there was, I'll let you guys name some, otherwise I'll steal them all of your favourite moments of that. But I'll pick the one I chucked off on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook, which was a bit of commentary that I think Alan Smith was a co-commentator, if I'm right in saying. And it's one of my favourite bits of commentary. And it's when the guy basically cries into his clapper. And there's this pause as the camera's watching him. And just as it cuts away to the match action again, Alan Smith goes, "Well, they're not supposed to be used for that, are they?" And I just thought that's got to hurt. Like, especially that guy. I don't think he'll ever live that down. So I thought that was a beautiful moment. That's enough from me. Who wants to chip in with their memories?
Yeah, well, my favourite part is the Yannick Bolasie move on the left for the cross for Wilf's header. The double move that he makes to create the space. I mean, you guys know I'm a huge Yannick fan, but the double move that he makes in that cross. And I always remember that Wilf talked about Holloway saying in training that week before that you have to get in at the back post as much as you can. And what happens is he does it and scores his first ever header. It's a brilliant. And the celebration is that the running into the stands, the slide. Oh, it's just brilliant. I just love the cross by, again, I'm a Yannick fan. That right footed cross. And Wolf is just cuts in inside a bridge. I mean, I can watch that over and over again. That's my favorite moment of that game. I mean, there's so many things, but that's my favorite moment of that match, was that play by Yannick and that header by Wolf.
Definitely. And I loved Wayne Bridges' reaction when the ball went in the net, because he just knew. And, you know, you had this whole thing and they were talking it up in the commentary. Oh, how Brighton have moved on. They got this lovely new stadium and they got the likes of Bridge and Upson playing for them. Yep. Just like, yeah, so what? but yeah, sorry to take us on that diversion back to the semi-final, but that's where my head was very much staying. So back over to you, Mike, to get into the details of the final itself.
I mean, you're right in that you're discussing a much more interesting game. And DR did retweet Jules' reaction from after the game, which is always worth seeing. It's up on Twitter if you haven't. Nice tear in his eye. But the final, so I knew that it would be a struggle. But on the other hand, I'd been subjected to Paw Patrol for the vast majority of the day. So any excuse to kick my youngest off the TV and tell her that, in fact, I was watching some football. Didn't explain to her that it wasn't live. And I watched the entire thing through without skipping anything. Some thoughts. Jedi's last gasp lunge tackle to stop a shot coming in the first half, which looked as though it was probably going to be the best chance of the half for Watford. Excellent. Dean Moxey forgot that he was quite so wily as he was. Ward and Zaha, with more build-up play than I remember. And Ward with some better crosses than I remember as well. Because he obviously, I don't know, he must have took a downturn in crossing skill for a few years after that. I remember it took me back to the day. Because I sent a message on WhatsApp asking everyone what happened to Yannick that day. And Patsy reminded me, I thought he was benched. There was nothing wrong with him. Holloway went with Johnny Esther, and that, yeah, I remember being worried about that, and I remember being worried about Wilbraham being our only outlet. But I also was thinking about the 2004 player final, and was like, "This is going to be fine. This is going to be fine. We're going to win 1-0." But I was still nervous as hell watching the game. But really nervous because it was such a typical stalemate, cancel each other out playoff final, and just the relief with the goal. It's a strenuous 153-minute watch, but on the other hand, if it means you don't get to watch PJ Masks and more Paw Patrol, then that is excellent.
Absolutely right. Go, Patrick, yeah. Lee, jump in.
Yeah, I want to add. Well, first thing is, I was there. So I hadn't been home in about 5 years, but I'd met someone on Twitter and becoming a good friend, Will Block, and he convinced me via Twitter, DMing me almost every day, to buy a ticket. So me and my son flew over for that match. So actually be there was phenomenal. It's one of the best memories I'll ever have with my son ever. He talks about it to this day. He's 20-odd years old now. He loves it. But from the match, couple of things that stand out to me. One is KG getting hurt. Now, KG, to me, had a brilliant match against Brighton in the second semi-final. And when he went off, I was really worried. But O'Keefe came on and was he was really, really good. He didn't do anything like spectacular, but the throwing the ball at that player, I can't remember who threw that in that second part of extra time, was hilarious to me. His work rate was brilliant. He was very steady. He picked up the ball, made good passes, drove the ball forward. I thought he did really well. Wilbraham misses. Mike mentioned before, Wilbraham had a lot of chances in that game. And as I was watching it back, I remember being in the stand and saying to myself, oh my God, I'm missing Glenn Murray. Murray would have scored that. Murray would have scored that. It was very frustrating. I mean, he worked hard, but his chances that he had, he really should have scored one of those four or five chances. Spironi was brilliant in that game. It was absolutely fantastic. But I realized that for the first 80 minutes, he had nothing to do. I believe the stat was he didn't have a save to make for the first 8 minutes. And that's how good our defence was. And let me give a shout out to players that we don't talk about a lot anymore. Dean Moxey had a great final. And so did Danny Gabadon. Gabadon, by the way,
was
a brilliant centre-half. You don't realise how good he was. Watch his last 3 matches. Watch the Brighton games again in the final. He's such a excellent football player and so smart. You know what I mean? He reads the game so well. You get to how he played at the highest level with West Ham, etc. Great player, Gabadon. I really love that.
Am I remembering it wrong? Or did we got him on a free at the start of that season?
I think you're right, Mike.
Yeah, well, it was a...
Yeah, go ahead.
I'd say it was a free because he had so many injury problems as well.
Right.
And I think when we took him on, I don't think we made him train very much. We did that with a few players. I mean, Clint Hill we nursed for a couple of years, not asking him to train more than, once or twice a week unless he could handle it. And we had a really good record of taking on players that that just needed that little bit of care and attention. And we did that with Gabadon. And you're so right. I mean, the semi-final against Brighton second leg, he was unbelievable in that game.
So
didn't even seem to break sweat. He was just everywhere. But yeah, and in the final, I remember it vividly. He was top class. And, you know, let's not forget, he was keeping Ramage out of the team, who had forged a brilliant partnership with Delaney. Yeah. But Gabadon had just managed to take that place and was just, yeah, magnificent.
And so just to finish off, the other abiding memory is Wolf's game. In and out of the game, but he really, whenever we needed someone to drive the ball forward, it was him. And then Cassetti, who made the foul, had actually, if you guys remember, he actually even had the same foul or a similar foul against Leicester in the semi-final. But of course, they missed the penalty, which went down and Deeney scored the goal. So the penalty kick now, Kevin Phillips, I don't know how you guys felt, but in the beginning of when it was happening, I turned my head. I said to myself, you can't miss this if it happens, you know, if we score. So quickly, I turned my head quickly, and as he shoots the ball and scores, and the place went crazy. I don't know if you know, the fans all match were absolutely, the sound was unbelievable. It was all Palace. And it was just a great, great, great time. And the whistle went, it was just that whole day. It was absolutely one of the best days of my entire life. To be a Palace fan that day was absolutely fantastic. I wouldn't have missed it for the entire world. I really wouldn't have.
Yeah, I mean, you've covered loads of the points that have been springing up in my mind as we were talking about it, and particularly the Wilbraham misses. And I have to say, Almunia was excellent in that game as well, to give Wilbraham a little bit of a let off. And you're right, thinking back, I felt a little bit embarrassed how I was calling Stuart O'Keefe massively overrated last week. And he was great in this game. But, you know, the Speroni save from Deeney, it was astonishing, considering what he'd done in the semi-final as well, for that. Probably one of the best saves I've ever seen. In fact, he probably is the best save I've ever seen. Against Ashley Barnes, just it was so good you didn't see it at normal speed, you know. And then it was zero doubt; it wasn't luck that it touched his hand. You know, the movement of his hand is almost physically impossible to move your hand that quickly, but he did it. So, and then for him to make that save from Deeney, because you know Deeney just thought he was going to walk the ball in, and yeah, Jules had other thoughts, thankfully. But you know, I think, for me, even though I haven't watched it back, it's so burnt into my mind from when I watched it in Wembley. I can remember all the emotions. I can remember laughing and saying, you know, trying to explain the tears in my eyes that I had a bad hay fever, but laughing about it. And just the sort of camaraderie, the noise. Like you say, Watford never came into it. They were so busy talking themselves up as a fan base, but they shrunk, and the Palace fans were never let up at all. And it was a hard watch at times. It was, you know, I never felt that we were going to lose as such. But, you know, I watched the penalty. I couldn't, you know, sometimes I do feel like turning away from moments like that. But it was just so important. I couldn't. And I thought, you know, I almost had that thought, well, if he does miss it, I'm going to be there with him to miss it. I'll experience the same pain and anguish if he misses it that he'll experience. I just wasn't going to let a minute of it pass me by. And as you say, Patrick, it was an unbelievable day.
So I went with my old man and his like social club lot. He's not a Palace fan, but he does enjoy a drink. So I only remember up to Vidra getting knocked out by Jedi, I think. And then the penalty. And I was so battered the rest of it that I don't remember until I watched it back on TV sometime later. But I also remember Alders. I worked in Alders in Croydon, and it actually closed down just before that final. I think it closed down December 2012. So I just started a new job, like as a temp, and I was absolutely penniless. And my horror, my debit card getting hammered that much when I saw the amount the next day. And I thought, if I'd have just stayed sober, I'd remember the game. It would have all been cool. I basically lived the day that Chris Clark does every time he watches Palace.
Oh, he's going to love that when he hears that. Sam, I've got to get a comment from you. How did you experience the playoff final?
At my parents on Sky Sports.
Yeah, but that's still great, right? You still had a fantastic time.
I did, yes. Yeah, and also quite a few drinks because we'd ordered in the Harveys again. That's our thing. It was amazing. I felt like it was one of those days that everything went right in the end.
Your dad's a massive Palace fan as well, though, right? So
he is, you know. Yes. Yeah, yeah.
You got to share the joy and the Harveys.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. I have become distracted thinking about the playoff final in way too much detail, but I think we better move on. Just a quick thing that Mike popped in the show doc, and it is relevant. You didn't watch it yourself, Mike, but the Max Meyer was playing for Palace in the EPL. I watched some of his game against James Maddison, but I turned it off when he started being typical Palace, and I didn't need that in my life. What was the end score in that one, Patrick?
3-2, James Maddison. We were up 2-1, and Maddison scored. It actually was a golden goal? Was that the next game with Michael Obafemi? No, he was second. Yeah, he won. It was just regular 3-2. But let me just say, he's a very good player. I've watched, again, I'm extremely bored. I do not play FIFA or watch FIFA. I have now watched Townsend, Wilf, and Max play full FIFA matches, which is very unlike me. But I think, I'm not an expert at DR better than me. I think Max is the best of the three by far. He does these little tricks and flicks moves that I don't see anybody else do on FIFA. I think Maddison might have mentioned that he's probably the best player he's played against, but Maddison won. He went up beating Michael Obafemi yesterday, I think 2-1. And I think he got to the final. I didn't watch it after that. But he did really well. Again, I'm not a FIFA person. I was thinking about buying a stupid game now. That's how impressive by Max Meyer. I'm a Max Meyer fan anyway. So, but no, I thought it was enjoyable to watch.
I strongly advise you not to buy FIFA with your temper. Hmm.
Really?
You know how angry you get about Palace?
Yeah.
Like on a regular basis.
How about Football Manager? Try that.
Football Manager's fine, especially FM20. It's an enjoyable game.
How do I download it?
If you've got a Steam account on PC.
Don't, but I can look into it.
Yeah, you can just buy it and download it. It's fine. But Steam.
You got me into it. You've been doing that for the last couple of weeks, so
I have. Yeah, I've put that on pause because I'm playing a proper game where I'm actual Palace Manager with real players rather than putting the entire back of the Nest crew in there. Can I just say, as a little bit of a spoiler, if I ever do put something together that's worthwhile looking at, I actually put producer Sam in there as a player in the Palace youth team, and she left. She was the first player to leave. She went to Leicester. Really quickly, and has since moved on to Aston Villa. It's just a journeyman already. It's unbelievable behaviour.
Sorry.
Yeah, no loyalty whatsoever, you know. But there you go. And you were touted at one stage as the next Michael Owen, so I don't know how you feel about that.
Not great, to be fair.
No. I'd have been slightly upset about that as well.
I think Michael Owen's two titles, so that's bollocks, isn't it?
Absolutely right. Completely unrealistic. So yeah. But anyway, it's a nice little diversion. I can't really watch it when I get so angry about FIFA, and probably not as angry as producer Mikey does when he plays DR. And there's been many, many incidents to speak of in the past on that. But I was an angry FIFA player, and I've stopped buying it because of that. I don't need that in my life. So I feel that, Patrick, whilst you're in control of Palace and you're making Palace lose, I think it would probably be something in your life you don't really need.
Okay, thanks.
Because you'd be angry at Palace and at yourself. So
a double whammy.
So, Mike, I didn't see this news, but Roy is back involved in training from May the 18th. Any more to say on that than that?
There's obviously caveats to that. The plan is, provided that they're going back into training on May the 18th, and judging by Boris's statement, you'd have to say that they've been given the thumbs up to do that. That Roy is allowed to join them despite his age. So you could basically say that Palace could essentially, and I'm not saying, we're not saying they are, if somebody comes back and tweets us and says, oh, you're wrong. It looks as though Palace could do full training as of May the 18th. Therefore, that would give them a couple of weeks if the Premier League was to start in June.
Okay, nice one. Steve Parrish appeared on Sky Sports, and this kind of links into the whole project restart debate, really. So he's been doing a lot of media stuff after putting some comments out on the Palace website talking about, you know, his views on Project Restart and what it might look like and how it might work. And it was latched onto pretty quickly. I think Gary Neville was the first one to get him involved in discussions on Sky. He's since been on BBC as well, I think this morning at the time of recording, talking very calmly and eloquently about the challenges ahead, you know, making sure that the understood part is it's only going to be done if it's safe to do so. And the whole principles seem to be around, you know, making sure private testing is available and not taking up any resources that would have been used elsewhere. And I think, you know, again, making sure staff and players can be effectively isolated in groups, that training can work properly. There seems to have been a whole thought process in place that he's sort of revealed. And we'll get into the other side of Project Restart, which has been named in an independent article today as Project Sabotage. And we'll talk about it in just a sec. But I'll hand back over to you, Mike, on Parrish's comments.
Yeah, so he did a Sky Sports interview where he was looking at every part of the multimillionaire, but he did use the phrase the least worst option, and I like that because it's honest. He's been presented with the various options as of the other 19 chair people. And he's happy that it is the least worst option. So, I don't know what else you could say about it, provided it is restarting. He's of the opinion that it is going to be a compromise. He's not moaning. He knows it's going to be tough. And I just kind of like his professionalism and his realism. And it's just carrying on from that article that was on the Palace website. He's just being realistic about it and saying if it is going to happen, obviously it's going to be neutral grounds, that kind of stuff. And we're going to be one of the clubs that benefits the least from this because I know we haven't got a great record at home over the last few years, but after a period of people not seeing football, imagine the Palace fans. You know, it would be incredible. It's not going to happen. And they'll end up playing in Birmingham, whatever. But they're all realistic about it. And you know he would have spoken to Roy and asked him to relay the message to the fans. So, there's a nice sort of 1 minute and a half video, the most important bits that we've tweeted from his Sky Sports interview. If you haven't seen it, just scroll down our Twitter.
Thanks, Mike. And leading on from that, I chucked an article up in the document. Hopefully you've had a chance to read it. But if not, I'll do as quick a summary as I can. And so there's basically the article is written from the point of view that as part of Project Restart, there's been lots of problems to overcome. And the main one of those seems to have been a division within the 20 teams. That the bottom six in the Premier League have now been dubbed Project Sabotage. And, you know, although the article indicates it has been said in jest, but, you know, there's this underlying issue with the teams that are most at risk of relegation, that whatever they can kind of cling on to argue against the idea of restarting football in any form, they are going to cling on to. And there's no doubt that it will suit certain clubs more than others to basically say either the season is null and void and the same team start again next year, or if you do go back, you take relegation completely off the table. So it's, and the interesting part I found, again, I'm going to name two clubs that are named in the article. Aston Villa's one and our old friends Brighton and Hove Albion are the other. And Paul Barber of Brighton has been particularly vocal on this from day one. And it's so transparent and so tragic that, you know, and it's also so incredibly self-absorbed because, you know, the thought process that he talks about publicly just stops at the consideration of game integrity. So he starts talking about, you know, how unfair it would be on a team like Brighton, for example, who, you know, to play at a neutral stadium and lose home advantage. First of all, it completely steps outside reality because it's not like Brighton have got a home crowd to speak of that would help them in any way. But more importantly, they completely ignore the teams in the league below that have worked just as hard as them all season, have probably been better than them all season, to have that chance to play in the Premier League. If, you know, and it's not necessarily definite that Brighton would go down, but, you know, they've got a very tough run in as a Villa, and it's so transparent that their motivation for you know, sticking their oar in and stopping this moving forward is entirely self-motivated. And, of course, you can understand with the money involved, can't you? It's, you know, hundreds of millions of pounds. But I can't get away from the fact that, you know, if they'd played better up until now, it was all within their gift to do better than they've done. So I don't really understand the argument. So, look, I mean, I could go on all day about it, but I won't. There is an article in The Independent. If you just Google The Independent and Project Sabotage, you'll find it. Excuse me. Well worth a read. But any comments from the panel on that particular situation?
Yeah, my thing is that the article says the following. There's a huge financial cost of dropping out of the Premier League. Bump Six do have some justifiable complaints about the unfairness of potentially losing so much money because they've lost more money on neutral grounds that we're supposed to be at home. But this is the thing. The league has to start back at some point. I mean, the thing is financially, what Parrish was saying is that these games have to be played because they have no other way of getting any income. If it's not for the television revenue, there's no advertising revenue coming in. There's going to be no spectators watching the games, etc. So the game of football will be changed immensely if this season doesn't finish. And I'm not a big advocate of doing it at the expense of anybody's health. Don't get me wrong at all. I do not want it to start without people getting sick or, God forbid, dying. But the league has to play. It's the same over here in America. We're having the same problem with the NBA restarting, the NHL, Major League Baseball, football, etc. Sports over here have also stopped completely. But these leagues have to start at some point again because there's a huge financial cost. And we're talking about financial costs, okay, losing money. We're talking about leagues going out of business. And that's what's going to happen in England. So I get that you don't want to get relegated, but you just said made a great point, Chris. Teams that like Leeds want to get promoted, and they have as much right to that ability to come up as Brighton have to not going down. So again, this is a huge like there's a moral issue, there's an economic issue, but again, to me, they have to finish the league somehow. And I think the only way it gets done is the neutral. And if you don't like it, you know what? Just forfeit the matches.
Yeah, absolutely right. And whichever way they do it, can you imagine if the games don't go ahead, because then obviously Sky and the other broadcasters, you know, BT and probably I think Amazon have had all their games, but BT and Sky definitely, probably international as well. You know, there's contracts in place, so that money has to be recovered.
Yep.
So like, what happens then? So I guess it would have to be recovered from the Premier League, which would have to recover it from its clubs. You know, it's a mess no matter which way you do it, and the only obvious thing to do is to ensure that at the very least those games are played. And if you have to play it in a situation that's not ideal, at least it's not ideal for everybody. You don't make your own club's, you know, specific circumstances a reason to, you know, to get in the way of that. There was a great comment in the article. It said they're all so desperate to play in the league that they're willing to not play in the Premier League at all. And I thought that summed it up quite nicely.
Exactly.
I mean, just we can only go by other countries that have done similar stuff. But so Scotland had a vote of its 42 clubs, and it was literally 50-50 down the middle. And I think it was Dundee United that hadn't voted, and they were the final vote that sorted things out. So if this comes down to a vote, well, it's going to be a 14-6 vote against. So I feel it's a little bit irrelevant because the vast majority of the Premier League are going to want to carry this season on. So Brighton can go and do one.
Yeah, but Mike, there's also a thing I saw today, and Chris mentioned it's not the first time, but there are three players that tested positive on Brighton. They'd use that as their reason for not playing, that the players are sick. So what do you do then?
Well, I mean, it could be then that some of the other teams say, you know, if we've got a certain amount of players that have tested positive, then fine. But we go back to Parrish's least worst situation. And unless we stop and wait for a vaccine, you might see a team that's skeletal at best. But, you know, right now people are advertising that the South Korean League is live and people can watch that, you know, and it's actually getting traction. Frankly, if you saw Brendan Perrick playing, I think we'd still take some Palace right now. And I feel like that's the way it's going to go. But otherwise, if we're waiting for a vaccine, we're going to be waiting a long time.
Understood. And I think the one thing you've got going for you also is that Bundesliga is possibly starting soon. And I think if you see what happens in that league, how they hopefully test, they track and trace, see what happened with their players. If that works out, then I think it would be a goal for the EPL, regardless of who doesn't want to do it. But if that doesn't work out and you see players getting sick, then you're going to have a problem, I think, going forward. So let's see what happens.
Yeah, I think the argument is obviously to make sure that nobody gets sick through playing football, through the contact. I think if someone is unfortunate enough, in the case of the Brighton players, for example, although two of those were much earlier on in the pandemic, only one is fairly recent. You know, the simple matter is it's the same as a player getting injured or sick any other time. You know, they're not available and they won't be available for 2 weeks because they'll be being quarantined. And you have to live with that because it's something that's out in society at the moment. The danger comes is if you don't pick that up and you don't test people and then other players get ill because of it. And that is the thing that the medical staff are warning about. And that's the thing that the players are worried about. And that's why, you know, the thing that Steve Parish is saying is you have to make that environment as safe as humanly possible.
And just one last thing, I've noticed that the Belarusian league didn't stop. And I happened to click on yesterday on YouTube and they're actually showing the games live and they have the games on. There are no fans in there, but the players are playing normal football. There's no less contact. They're not wearing masks or gloves. Even the subs are not. They're sitting next to each other. There's no social distancing. So it's working somewhere in the world. So whether they're doing something different there or just not reporting it properly, it is being played in Belarus right now. So that's interesting to see.
Yeah, I'm not too up on their league and their society.
I am not either, by the way. I didn't see it yesterday on TV.
I'm secretly suspicious you're an expert, but all right.
Okay.
Well, let's leave that there. I'm sure it's something that will come up as we continue to do these shows and more information comes out. So obviously, we do have a quiz up next. I do want to ask a really quick question just to clean the palate before the quiz. And that is, I've started to notice, now I'm not saying I've necessarily done this, right? But when you, so in the world as it is now, obviously we know we've all moved to kind of Zoom chats and things like that, and we're quizzing with friends. I know everyone on this call has almost certainly done that. Am I right in saying?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, exactly.
Once or twice,
yeah. So, and it's, you know, it's a great thing to be able to do. I did something today for a couple of hours with friends, which I really thoroughly enjoyed, but you know, starting to get to that stage where you're getting, you know, quite a few invites and you're getting, there's quite a lot going on. And I'm not always the most sociable of people. And like in the past, you'd just be able to go, oh, I've got this to do. I've got that to do. I have no longer got any specific excuses really to avoid social interaction. And I'm just wondering, has anybody got any ideas or experience of the sort of things? Now, I haven't avoided anything so far. I'm just saying that right now, but it has entered my brain. I was double booked for a Zoom quiz today, but that was legit. I was double booked, and that's only my absent-mindedness. So, hey, Sam, you probably do a few. Have you got any excuses that you can come up with?
But double booking is a good one that we've been having a lot of, video lunches with parents and family members to avoid people. You can always go there with women's problems.
Well, I can't.
Why not?
I suppose, yeah. I mean, in this day and age, gender is a construct, guys, you know, guys and girls.
Exactly.
Or them. I get confused. I'm old. But yeah, all right. That's some good tips there. Yeah. How about yourself, Mike? You got any tips for me?
I mean, I'm sort of that friend that people have where they know, I fancy a drink today. Mike will be out for it, and if I say I'm double booked, it's because I am. What else am I going to do than chat shit to people with a beer in the evening? Like, either that, or I go and share a bedroom with my son who snores like a. Yeah, I mean, I'd rather make sure I've passed out, to be honest.
No, fair play. Patrick, you had to avoid anything?
No, but the double booking sounds like a great plan.
That's really literally all we got, and people are going to get wise to this, right? They're going to get suspicious. What do you mean you're double booked? Who with? Who else do you know?
Psoriasis.
That's a good one. I suppose, you know, with the fact we can now go out for more exercise on multiple occasions and go sunbathing, we're starting to get some more excuses. So fingers crossed that works in our favour. But anyway, thanks for your input, everyone. That was lovely. So let's end. And you're going to love this quiz almost as much as I definitely did. Right, it's time for the quiz, and an extremely pissed Sam is going to take us through it. Hello, Sam.
Good evening.
Sounds like it has been a good evening.
Yes.
So what's the nature of this quiz, then?
The nature of this quiz is Back of the Nest associates with the number 75 or the numbers 7 or 5 or 70 or 50.
Okay.
So, are we ready?
So, yeah, I'm ready.
First question. Max Meyer is currently wearing the number 7 shirt, but who wore it from 2007 to 2009? A. Carl Fletcher, B. Scott Sinclair, C. Ben Watson, or D. Sean Derry?
I mean, I've taken a punt there, and I'm not 100% sure that that's the case. But, I mean, he definitely did wear it. It just depends if all those others did. I don't think Ben Watson did. So the correct answer was, Sam?
Carl Fletcher.
Yay! Yeah. Who went Ben Watson?
Jeez. I did, of course.
Ah, oh, lucky fam.
It was a toss-up between 1 and 2. So they went...
Should have cheated.
Right. Good times.
Question 2. Sticking with shirt numbers. James Tompkins wears the number 5 shirt, but which of the following players didn't wear the number 5 for Palace? A. Eric Young, B. Patrick McCarthy, C. Mark Hudson, or D. Jonathan Parr? I don't know why I went full names there.
But
that just happened. I mean,
it's got to be the one who wasn't a centre back, right?
Yeah.
It was 100% there. Everyone got that. Well done, everyone.
Good. 1975 was one of the years that Crystal Palace achieved record consecutive away matches without a defeat. How many matches was that? 8, 9, 10, or 11?
I should know this. That's not fair, though. I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know, so I've guessed to get as quick an answer as I could. 8, 9, 10, or 11.
I should know.
But you never go one end of the scale or the other, do you? Oh, no one got that right.
It was 10. And they also achieved the same record in 28 to 29, 68 to 69, and 78 to 79. So there you go.
Yeah, there we go indeed. Oh, okay. Gosh. On to the next.
Wait until we get... Right. Crystal Palace's record FA Cup result was 7-0 and was achieved in 1929. Name the club who lost. Southend United, Luton Town, Bolton Wanderers, or Portsmouth?
I have to say, I'm deeply suspicious of how quickly producer Mikey is answering these. But anyway.
He does have a login for the quiz thing.
Exactly. Oh, no one got it right, though, so maybe my conspiracy is around that question. But it was, of course, Luton Town, wasn't it, Sam?
Of course it was, yes, as we all remember from 1929.
Yeah,
And interestingly, or not interestingly, a fact, Bolton Wanderers went on to win the FA Cup that year, beating Portsmouth in the final 2-0, which is why they were both answers on the...
I was going to say, how is that interesting? That's not even the answer to the question.
That's been the best.
The team won it. Excellent.
Facts. Woo. Next question then.
Yeah, go for it.
Question 5. Who scored the most goals for Crystal Palace in the 75-76 season? Dave Swindlehurst, Mick Hill, Peter Taylor, or Alan Whittle?
Let me tell you something.
I mean, it's unfair because Patrick was in the crowd as a fresh-faced 40-year-old.
11. 10. 10. I'm getting you.
Oh dear! I've had a punt, but I think it might be one other. It could have been.
Who got it right?
Yay! I did.
Only one person.
I got it right. It was Dave Swindlehurst, wasn't it?
Of course it was. Scoring 19 goals.
It could have been Peter Taylor, because Peter Taylor had a great season that year. We got to the FA Cup semi-final. Sam, what are you doing this to me for? Why?
Jesus. Because I like to torture. I don't know. Yeah. Okay. Swindlehurst was also the top scorer or joint top scorer in the 76, 77, 77, 78 and 78, 79 seasons.
Yes, he was.
There you go.
So there you go. Question six. Crystal Palace recently shared a photo of the programme from the end of the 44 to 45 season, 75 years ago. But what was the final result of the last home game of the season against Brentford? A 6-1 loss, a 6-1 win, a 5-3 loss, or a 5-3 win?
See, oh, I don't know. I remember this now.
I don't know, but I always go for the loss if it's Palace. So.
Exactly. You'd have thought. However.
Oh, wow.
It was.
Oh, no, they didn't win, did they?
Who got that right?
I did. I thought I suddenly remembered it was a 5-3 loss, but yeah.
Oh. Here we go.
But it just moves on too quickly. Question seven. Jim Cannon, who played for most of the 70s, holds the record for most competitive professional match appearances. What is the record number? 657, 660, 663 or 666?
This is the most tenuous link to the 75th anniversary of VE Day.
The thing is, it's like, I know he's got the highest, you know, the record, but I can't possibly know which of those it is. Just had to guess, and I guessed wrong, and so did everybody else.
Everybody guessed wrong. The answer was 663.
Of course it fucking was. Yeah, how stupid of us.
I'm really annoyed that I guessed at a round number, though, as well. And it definitely, you can eliminate the round number, 660, and you can see that Sam has enjoyed putting 666 in there, hasn't she? So you can eliminate that one as well. So it was between 657 and 663.
And this hey,
Mike,
isn't
you know,
even...
the funniest part? You're winning and you're upset.
Oh, dear. Here we go.
This isn't the most tenuous question either. They get worse as we go along. Question eight. What is the name of the longest serving manager who managed the club from 1907 to 25? Just Edward stop. Shaw, Christopher Robson, Jack Croft or Edmund Goodman?
I mean, I'm hopeful I know this one.
How?
I just reading my Palace history, mate. I mean, I'd be terrible if I'm wrong, because now I've sort of said I've read my Palace history. But I'm sure it was this guy. Boom! Yeah,
you were right. It was Edmund Goodman, who was in charge for 613 matches, excluding wartime competition.
One of the founders, of course, Edmund Goodman, wasn't he? And took over the club a couple of years after the original date of founding. So there you go. Who went Jack Croft?
Me.
Have you ever heard of Jack Croft?
No.
No? Okay. There we go. All right, on we go.
And finally, oh no, question nine, not finally.
Nearly finally.
Oh no. Crystal Palace beat Clapham 7-0 in 1905. What was the attendance? 1,500, 1,200, 3,000 or 2,200?
See, I know you've put a note saying we're scraping the barrel, but we're not scraping the barrel. That's just not related to the 75th anniversary of VE Day. That's all that is. That's 40 years before VE Day.
Oh, two of you got it as well.
That'd be me, by the way.
Oh, you and Mikey Fairley got 1,500. See, that's like too round a number.
Sorry. I don't think it was accurate. If that's
I was going to say, that's just pure guesswork from somebody 20 years later writing a book, isn't it?
Should we avoid that question off then? Agree.
I love my anger. I love it. I really do.
Question 10. The 50-51 season sees Palace's record of fewest league goals scored in a season, a feat they also matched in the 2013-14 season. How many goals did they score? 31, 33, 35 or 37?
If I'd read the 13-14 part of that question, I would have guessed differently.
Who got it wrong? Who got it right? Somebody got it right.
It was Michael Fairley again, who's had an extraordinary run for someone with the access to the answers to questions.
So sweet.
I've turned off my tumble dry just to make an appearance.
Congratulations.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable scenes. So, well, Sam, do you want to take us through the leaderboard?
To the leaderboard, and I still don't understand the scoring on this.
I don't understand the quiz, so fuck the scoreboard.
So, I mean, look, I mean, obviously, you've been drunk presenting the quiz. How drunk were you when you made the quiz, just out of interest?
This is a two-day effort.
superb work. Right. Cool.
Coming in at fourth. I can't do this.
That'd be me.
Patrick O'Connor with 18 points.
Well done, Patrick.
Yeah, cheers.
No, I'm done.
Oh, you're done, are you? So in third place. On the podium, though, Mike, I'm sure you're proud to once again take your place. On that podium, 23 points, right? Yeah? Yeah? That's good, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, that's good. And then, yeah, you've come up in second there on 28.
And Michael Fairley, producer of this show, tops the table with 38 points, 10 clear of everybody else. Astonishing.
The spiritual winner there is Sam. Because it's certainly not the number 75.
I mean, to be fair, they all involve the number 7 or the number 5 or some variation thereof.
That is what I was going for.
But I don't think I've ever seen anything quite as tenuous. I think it's the most tenuous thing I've ever seen in my life. So I can't say I enjoyed that, Sam, but it was good. It was a good effort. No.
Sorry.
It's fine. Cracking by. Thanks, Sam. And also, thank you for joining us and helping present it so professionally.
Yeah.
Thank you very much indeed for listening. Thank you to Mike for producing, for Sam for lurking, and obviously for Mike and Patrick. I just called Mikey Mike, didn't I? Upsetting stuff. Mike and Patrick for being on the panel as well. Do check out the preview show, which will be out in the middle of the week. And of course, we'll be back again next week. Stay safe. Speak to you soon.
Back of the Chest, Coronavirus Self-Isolation Podcast.
It's the 90th minute. All your mates around. You've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Your mate's already got booked for double dipping and you steal the last nugget, snatching all 3 points. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. You in? At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network.
TalkSport. Powered by fans.